Welcome to this season of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. I'm Professor Belinda Lennox. I'm a psychiatrist and a researcher here in Oxford. And this season, you'll be joining me as we demystify the science behind the most complex object in the known universe, our brains, and look at the wide-reaching impacts of mental illness on individuals and society. I'll be introducing you to some of Oxford's best academic minds working to solve the greatest challenges in brain and mental health. And I'll also be speaking to guests from beyond the university to bring their perspectives and lived experience and get a sense of the impact of what we're doing. Join us as we discover how Oxford is shaping the future of brain and mental health research. So welcome to another episode of the Future Makers podcast. And it's my great pleasure this afternoon to be joined by my colleagues, Professors Cathy Creswell and Polly Waite. And we're here to talk about childhood anxiety. So to start off with, maybe, I don't know, do you want to tell me how you got into this area of research and really why it's so fascinating?
Yes, definitely. So I've been working on child anxiety for a really long time now. My PhD focused on that just after I trained as a clinical psychologist. In fact, Polly and I trained together as clinical psychologists many years ago. And during my clinical training, I very much enjoyed working with children and young people. And that was definitely the direction I wanted to go in. But I also was very interested in psychological therapies. And anxiety disorders are an area where there'd been huge advances in psychological therapies for adults, but there was really quite a substantial gap in relation to the application of those treatments for children, but some really promising work at that time. So it really brought together my sort of passion for working with children and families, but also this drive to try to improve psychological therapies. And then sort of have carried on from there and not really moved out of that area since.
That didn't make you, Polly.
Yeah, I think from my point of view, so I'd worked once qualifying with both children and with young adults, really enjoyed all of that. But one of the things that I became really aware of, I think, when I was working with children was a lot of the research that we were doing and a lot of the clinical treatments saw children, adolescents, as if they were one big group. So between sort of 6 to 18, as if, you know, they thought the same way and they behaved the same way. And it seemed to me that actually there were particular things that were really unique to teenagers specifically, and a lot of treatments, you know, weren't really addressing that. So I became particularly interested in teenagers with anxiety to try and sort of think more specifically about their needs.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say. I suppose it's a sort of marker of paediatrics perhaps, and child psychiatry certainly, is that everything is developed backwards from adults rather than actually starting with children. So I suppose, you know, that's a sort of a starting question. Is there anything different about anxiety in a child or an adolescent compared to an adult?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so my focus is predominantly with the pre-adolescents. And one thing that's very clear is that we tend to see different sorts of anxiety disorders appearing at different points in development. And some anxiety disorders are much more common in younger children. Others are much more common in adolescents. So, for example, in the younger children, we see a lot more separation anxiety. We also see a lot more phobias as well. Whereas in adolescents, we really see a big increase in social anxiety, don't we, and panic disorder. And also more comorbid low mood problems start to appear at those times. So just at that very basic level, we see quite marked differences in how things present. And then obviously the interference that that causes also varies in its nature, because I guess younger children probably have a bit less choice and agency in terms of what happens in their lives. So they might still be at school, for example, but might be struggling to get there or struggling when they're there. Whereas in adolescence, obviously, there's a bit more agency and people, you know, young people can start to, avoid places that might be harder to avoid when you're younger and you kind of just get put in places.
Yeah, sure. And they're common, right? I mean, you know, we all recognise the term anxiety, but even separation anxiety or phobias, I mean, everybody, it's part of normal experience to some extent.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because the onset of the disorders tends to coincide with when actually you see those fears happening as something that's developmentally normal. And really what distinguishes what we'd call an anxiety disorder is when the severity and the impairment is such that it's getting in the way of everyday life and stopping normal developmental experiences. So actually many children may have problems with anxiety that, you know, kind of come and go, or they feel worried about things, but it doesn't really stop them doing anything or cause a particular amount of distress. So that's what we're really looking at in the clinic, is this now at the point where it's actually been sticking around for a while and is really interfering in this person's life?
Yeah, no, sure. And in adolescence, it sounds as though it's a subtly sort of different profile, Polly. I mean, are these basically the sort of the evolution of disorders that, if left untreated, can sort of persist into adulthood?
Yeah, I think that's right. And what we see generally, actually, in terms of prevalence rates, is from children into adolescence and adolescence into sort of young adults, actually rates tend to increase over time. So, yeah, but it's interesting how things like in teenage years, you know, Kathy mentioned social anxiety being particularly prevalent. And that makes sense when we think about the kind of developmental things, what's happening in teenagers' lives. They become so much more focused on what their peers think and how they're coming across. So a lot of that makes sense in the context of sort of normative development.
Well, so I know that you've been doing a lot of work during COVID, a lot of amazing work actually profiling the change in anxiety disorders over the period of lockdown and after. Do you just want to summarise maybe the sort of what you found?
Yeah, I can do that. So we launched the CoSpace study within a month of the first national lockdown in COVID. So that was in March 2020, 3 years ago now. And we were really interested in understanding the experience of young people in terms of the pandemic and trying to kind of track what was happening over time. So we recruited over 8,000 families. It wasn't a representative sample, so we always have that major caveat that we're not able to look at things like prevalence rates, but we're really interested to sort of understand what was happening over time, and in particular to think about what we could do to support families during that really difficult period. And so families very kindly filled in monthly surveys. It was mainly parent report, and we had some really interesting findings. So The first finding that was such an important finding was actually that we just saw really high elevated rates of mental health difficulties across particular young people. So children with special educational needs, neurodevelopmental disorders, so things like autism, families where they're from single adult households or low income, just had these high rates that persisted all the way through. And then on top of that, we saw particular patterns where there were periods of restriction, where there were school closures and national lockdowns. So we saw that in particular, primary school age children were particularly affected by that, particularly when it came to symptoms like attentional symptoms and hyperactivity. They were definitely struggling more in those kind of periods. And we also saw with secondary school age children, although on the whole, their symptoms were a bit more stable, actually, we still saw those same patterns where at periods of restrictions, actually, they were struggling a bit more, as also were their parents, not surprisingly. So parents of children across the age range were experiencing, you know, more symptoms of depression and stress at those times. So really, you know, it was really evident that actually the pandemic was affecting different people in different ways, but particular interventions like the restrictions, you know, had particularly pronounced impacts for young people.
Yeah, I suppose that completely makes sense, doesn't it? So that populations at higher risk anyway of developing mental disorders were at even higher risk in lockdowns in particular. And it was the sort of social restrictions and the being away from schools, do you think? I mean, is that your sort of instinct that that's the sort of the causative?
I think it makes sense, doesn't it, that, you know, families were really struggling, particularly in that first lockdown, very little support, you know, suddenly shifting to kind of being in a home environment. And parents, you know, right from the get-go were just describing to us how they were really struggling to manage the needs of their child and, you know, all the other things that they needed to do as a parent. You know, many of them really felt that they needed parenting support, and that led on to some other work that we've sort of done with colleagues. So I think, yeah, I think it reflects the fact that they were very much on their own, really struggling for support, and that was having sort of quite significant implications.
Yeah. So what happened over time as you tracked throughout the last couple of years? Did the situation improve?
Well, those are the kind of things we're looking at now, actually. So we're really interested now to understand, you know, which children have bounced back, which children are struggling, and to understand the sort of patterns and whether there are particular predictors of children in the longer term who, you know, perhaps still aren't doing so well and that we might really need to think about. So I think there's still so many questions to answer in all of this.
Yeah, completely. Thank you, Polly. Another area, I suppose, more controversial, maybe just as controversial as, you know, there's a lot of narrative, there's a lot of media reports around the rise in childhood mental illness and the rise of anxiety disorders. I don't know if you want to say anything about the sort of the evidence base behind that, or perhaps some of your thinking through some of these large scale surveys you've done as to, you know, whether it is a detection issue or whether it is a true increase, perhaps.
Yeah, so I think, well, the work that we've done, I think we can't really draw any conclusions about prevalence because, as Polly said, it's a particular sample. But there is some other fantastic work that's been done that works very hard to get representative samples and does very in-depth diagnostic assessments with children and young people from around the country. And using consistent methods over time, that data has shown quite a substantial increase in mental health problems in children and young people over time. And certainly, there were increases that were shown during the pandemic, but actually we were already on an upward trajectory. We've seen it in those sorts of national surveys. We also are seeing it in referrals to mental health services. So recently there's been a 40% increase in referrals to child and adolescent mental health services. So the need is very apparent. There, of course, always is the question, was the need always there, but people weren't reporting it or people weren't asking for help? I think the fact that the data that we do have, which is comes out of NHS Digital, has used very consistent measures, gives us some reason to think that actually it's not just about reporting. People were asked the same exactly the same questions. But of course, people's willingness to talk about things may have changed. And I think our impression is probably it's a bit of a combination. So it does seem, you know, when you talk to mental health services, when you talk to schools, that the general feeling is that everyone who's working with children and young people are seeing a lot more mental health problems. So I think it's not just about reporting and willingness to talk. People are noticing, young people are struggling. But there also is an element that people, I think, are, you know, some of the stigma has gone somewhat, and that people are more able to talk about it and more able to ask for help, which is a good thing.
Yeah. And I suppose, and following on from that, I mean, do you get a sense, certainly from your clinical work, that it's across the board, that the presentations now are just more of the sort of what we saw before? I'm just thinking in particularly, there seems to be data about particular increases in eating disorders in particular amongst young girls. And you can sort of understand perhaps why the particular circumstances of the pandemic might have sort of precipitated that. But do you sense sort of across the board in young people a rise in anxiety disorders?
Yeah, so I mean, you're absolutely right. So for example, referrals for eating disorders really went up substantially following the lockdowns and the pandemic. And I guess that we don't know whether it's the particular circumstances of the restrictions or whether it's that people weren't able to get help until late on, which may be elevated need dramatically. But so there was a particular need there. In terms of anxiety disorders, I mean, certainly the most recent data suggests that we are seeing specific increases in the rate of anxiety disorders as well. And particularly, as Polly was saying, in at the adolescent age and the older adolescents, and particularly amongst girls.
Okay. I wonder, why do you think that's the case? I mean, are there sort of, well, I mean, that's an impossible question, isn't it? But, you know, are there particular, is it the impact particularly of the sort of social aspects of lockdowns and the pandemics? Is it, I don't know, have you got ideas?
It's really difficult to know. I mean, I think, you know, we've got lots of research that tells us about what some of the risk factors are for developing an anxiety disorder in general, which inevitably, of course, is a reflection of some sort of biological factors and then environmental factors. So in terms of sort of, biological factors, we see that anxiety tends to run in families. And we know that there are particular characteristics that make some young people more at greater risk of developing an anxiety disorder. So things like having an inhibited temperament, where, you know, if you're put in a novel situation, you might be more likely to sort of avoid or withdraw. So, you know, we're all just built differently. We have different temperaments, and that kind of temperament does put you at a much greater risk of an anxiety disorder by about sevenfold. Things like having a parent with an anxiety disorder, that sort of increases your risk of having an anxiety disorder twofold. So we know that there are some of these particular characteristics, environmental factors. So a lot of research has been done on things like parenting, understanding not only how that might potentially You know, the way that you might parent your child might present a risk for developing anxiety problems, but also that it goes back in the other way. So actually, an anxious child tends to invoke particular responses by parents or other adults. So we've got quite a lot of data around all of these different things that we know are important. You know, there's some data about things like peer relationships or other kind of environmental factors. But I think in terms of understanding what's going on now, you know, there's less of that data, but some of those environmental factors are likely to be really important in terms of what, you know, what everyone's going through in terms of things like the cost of living crisis, you know, financial difficulties, increased pressure for young people. All the things, you know, that are related to COVID. So, yeah, I think it's probably a complex picture.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one area where there's really been very little research in relation to anxiety disorder specifically is people's school experiences. And obviously young people, children and young people, spend a very substantial amount of their time at school. And in studies where they've asked children and young people who have problems with anxiety what they worry about, actually it's school related things that tend to come out at the top, but yet we have very little research about those young people's experiences at school. And I guess that, you know, in recent years we've seen increasing pressures within school systems, and we certainly know that children who have special educational needs are at increased risks of mental health problems generally, not specifically anxiety. So, you know, you might imagine that there may be many young people who do have needs that aren't quite being met in the school environment, given all the pressures that there are within that environment. So that might be another important factor, as well as, you know, with the pressures that are in the system, you know, managing the social side of it, you can imagine may have become something that's a bit trickier to do. And, you know, and that's something obviously that children and young people are having to navigate, you know, quite challenging social environments in many respects. So all of those sort of experiences that children are having on a day-to-day basis, I think, have been very much neglected in the research, but obviously a really important area for us to look at going forwards.
Completely. And it seems so obvious now you're saying it, Kathy, as you say, that children spend a large proportion of their time in these environments that, I mean, the opportunity for intervening in those environments as well.
Absolutely.
At a school level.
Yeah, and there's been some recent research that's come out that's really highlighted the potential role of academic pressure as well, which I think is something that, again, in relation to anxiety specifically, has not received a lot of attention. But again, you know, again, it's the sort of thing that young people talk about a lot as being an important factor.
And that would fit with the prevalence rates that we see, where they really jump up in the sort of 17 to 19 year olds, you know, that really critical period where, you know, many of them have got A-levels looming, you know, mock exams where that, you know, dictates the potential university places, you know, 40% of them are applying for university. So there's a huge amount of pressure, I think, at that point in life in terms of social stuff, you kind of developing intimate relationships, all of that, leaving home. I think there's so many things going on at that point in life. And it's really hard for young people, particularly when there are other aspects, like in terms of the biology, you know, your developing brain is still got years of developing particular things like, you know, all those skills, organisation, problem solving, motivation, all of those bits of the brain still got another sort of few years of developing. And yet you're in this environment that's got lots and lots of challenges where actually those skills are really important.
Yeah, you're triggering me slightly, Polly. Thinking back. Well, it is an absolute terrible time. Well, I found it as an adolescent growing up. The academic pressures, the social pressures, the sort of developing as a human being and, you know, who am I? What's the point? You know, all of these things sort of coalesce around a sort of really vulnerable developing brain. It's a wonder that anybody gets through it without significant mental health problems, quite honestly. It's a particularly female issue, though, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, I think particularly emotional disorders, we do see higher rates in young women. But we also, I think, have particular difficulties in providing treatments to young men who may not present for treatment. So, you know, in a lot of our recent treatment studies, we've got two adolescent treatment studies recently. And when you look at the data, the proportion of young men in those studies is lower than it should be on the basis of the prevalence data. So it's sort of twofold that, yes, it is young women that tend to have these difficulties, but actually the young men that do have those difficulties are not necessarily making it into services and making it into treatment.
Ah, that's really interesting. So still, even with the sort of increased acceptance of mental health problems, perhaps there's a discrepancy there. It's not particularly in young men. Maybe there's still an issue with the sort of acceptability of having emotional difficulties?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Hello, I hope you're enjoying this episode of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. If you'd like to learn more about our work here in Oxford, head to ox.ac.uk/brain or let us know what you think on social media using the hashtag OxfordBrain.
So I suppose that leads on to the treatment developments because, you know, although it's a very common problem and can be, you know, very disabling actually to whole families, there are really good evidence-based treatments now, both for the children and for the families. I don't know, do you want to start by discussing what the treatments that you've developed, Kathy?
Yes, yeah, well, we've very much been influenced by work that's happened here in Oxford over, you know, decades, in the development of very highly effective interventions for anxiety disorders in adults. So there's been a lot of work in the development of cognitive therapy, which is very much about understanding how people's belief and thought processes might lead them to interact with the world and how it can sometimes prevent opportunities for new learning. And so through intervention, you're helping people to notice those sort of thinking patterns and find ways to go and make new discoveries about the world. And so we've been very influenced by that work. And so I guess our starting point was, I think when we both came into this, there'd been quite a lot of work looking at cognitive behaviour therapy, it's a sort of broader term, for a broader range of treatments that take a similar sort of approach, had been used with children and young people. And there have now been quite a lot of studies evaluating that. And generally you find by the end of treatment, about half of the children are free of their anxiety disorder. Some will then continue to get better over the following period. And I guess there are two main challenges that we've been trying to face. One is about, well, okay, so that, you know, you've got a good number of children and young people who are getting, who will get better from those treatments, but hardly anyone is accessing it. So we need to really increase access. And then the second is you've obviously also got a good chunk of children and young people who are not getting the best outcomes that they could from those treatments. So we also need to understand who's not benefiting and what do they need. Mm. So these are really the two questions that we're trying to address in much of the research that we're doing. So maybe if I start with the access bit and then Polly could pick up on the how we make treatments better part. With the access part, we've been particularly, a lot of our work has been focusing on the pre-adolescent age. And the reason for that has been that, well, first, as I said, we have treatments that work reasonably well, but we found really low access rates among pre-adolescent children. So one of our colleagues, Tessa Reardon, did a study where she went around the country identifying children in the community who met diagnostic criteria for an anxiety disorder, but finding them through their schools, not through services. And essentially, this was a few years ago, but at that time, she found that of those children who had an anxiety disorder, so a level of anxiety that's significantly interfering in their day-to-day life, 2% of them had had cognitive behaviour therapy, which is the one treatment that has a significant evidence base behind it. So that obviously is horrifying, isn't
it? Well, just to pause there a second, I mean, that is horrifying.
Yeah.
Is that's 2% received the treatment.
Yeah.
How many asked for the treatment, do you know?
So that's a good question. So more than 2% had got to services. I'm trying to think of the exact numbers now. About 2/3 of families had tried to get some support somewhere. For many of them, they got some sort of support from within their school. So that at that time, that may have been, you know, sort of pastoral support work. And then a much smaller number had got to specialist services. And then a tiny number had got the one evidence-based treatment. So this is a few years ago. And actually, there have been some really fantastic service developments since then. So things are absolutely improving and moving in the right direction. But we were very, you know, motivated by this to think, well, how can we make these treatments more accessible? And the thing was that because, as you were saying before, the way that cognitive behaviour therapy had very much developed for children and young people was we've got these adult ones versions that work quite well, let's make them child friendly. So they move from working with one individual adult to working with one individual child, which means you have to take a lot of time over it because you need to build the relationship, you need to make it fun, and you can't pack too much into a session. So you end up with quite lengthy treatments. Then people thought, well, actually, the parents obviously are around when the therapist's not. Can we help work with the parent as well to, you know, amplify the effects? And essentially what people tended to find then was adding on the parents as well. You know, you get good results, but it doesn't necessarily get better results. But then what we found was if we only work with the parents, we could get those same results again, but much, much more quickly, because we're working directly with the parents and they can implement strategies in their child's day-to-day life. And actually what we also heard from parents in many cases was that they didn't necessarily, a potential barrier was having to take their child to a clinic where they might feel a bit odd and feel, they might feel like a quite unusual experience. They might have to miss other things that were important to them. So actually parents told us that early support, they would really like to be empowered to help their child, to put things into practice in their child's day-to-day life, not disrupt their child's routine. And of course, by doing it, we could take an approach where we share lots of material with parents and then just help them work out how to apply it with their child based on the expertise they already have about their child. So we were able to get our treatments from what had been about 16 hours down to about 5 hours of therapist support without compromising treatment outcomes. And more recently, we've moved to a digital version of that treatment where the amount of therapist involvement is about 2 hours. And again, we've found we don't compromise treatment outcomes at all by doing it. So it's really just about trying to find ways to deliver treatment more efficiently, but without compromising on those clinical outcomes, and hopefully along the way overcoming other barriers that parents might face. So we found with the digital version, parents can access the content whenever they like, and they, you know, they really, you know, they'll be doing it at midnight after having done all the other jobs and things that need to be done, and then they just have quite a short phone call with a therapist who helps them think about how to apply it with their child or overcome problems that they've had with it. So parents tell us that it, you know, it does actually make it much more accessible in many ways, not just because of the amount of time. So that's an example of the work we're doing to try to increase access and how that's gone. But also there's a lot of work going on just trying to understand how we improve outcomes as well. So do you want to pick up there?
Yes, definitely. So so obviously my stuff is all much more focused on adolescents, and a colleague of ours, Eleanor Lee, and work with David Clark have also been focused on teenagers with anxiety disorders. And in terms of sort of, you know, what does the evidence suggest to, kind of prior to all of this, we did a meta-analysis quite recently looking at sort of outcomes for teenagers, and actually often their outcomes aren't great, and treatment is really lengthy. So this meta-analysis that Holly Baker, a PhD student of ours, did recently showed that the average length of treatment was about 17 hours. So, you know, again, if you've got services that are really stretched, 17 hours of therapy is a lot of therapy. So we've been really focused, again, like Kathy, thinking about how do we deliver treatment that's actually more effective and really efficient. So if I start with some of the work that Eleanor's been doing, because she's done some brilliant work specifically on social anxiety, which, you know, we know is really highly prevalent. So they've developed a cognitive therapy specific treatment for social anxiety based on David Clark and Adrian Wells's original treatment for adults. And they've developed an internet version. So like Kathy, really optimising kind of digital interventions to be able to get a lot of that material over to young people. And their treatment is just 6 hours of therapist time. So again, really got the time right down. And they found 77% of their teenagers with social anxiety were free of their social anxiety post-treatment, and over 90% at six-month follow-up. So that's very exciting, because that's very far from where the remission rates are with the broader literature. And the work that I've been doing has been more focused on panic disorder, which has been a really neglected area when it comes to adolescent anxiety disorders. I think partly because it doesn't tend to present in younger children. So, you know, often clinicians don't even recognise it. And often our teenagers with panic attacks are quite socially anxious as well. So they worry about having a panic attack. They worry that there's something wrong with them. When they get those physical sensations, they tend to catastrophically misinterpret them and think they're about to faint or something awful is going to happen. But also they often worry about what other people think. So we've adapted, again, a really successful adult treatment, and the brief version of that treatment. So again, it's just 5 hours of therapy time, plus two booster sessions each for now, so sort of up to 7 hours. And we've just done a feasibility study comparing that new treatment to a general CBT approach, which is really great, because to be able to sort of look at the gold standard treatment and then a newer treatment. And so this was just a feasibility study, so it's just a small scale study to sort of understand things like, can we recruit young people? Is the treatment acceptable? You know, what do they think of it? But we've also been looking at their outcomes as well. And what's really encouraging is both treatments, actually, the cognitive therapy therapy and the general CBT are really highly effective. But what we're also seeing is this newer approach, this cognitive therapy, seems to have the edge on our standard treatment in terms of the number of young people that reliably improved at the end of that treatment was actually 100% of the young people in the trial, and that compared to 56% of those that had had general CBT. And we've just done a one-year follow-up, and it looks like on the whole those gains have been maintained. So that's really exciting that we can develop treatments, maybe make them a bit more disorder-specific. We can optimise, you know, workbooks in the case of the panic treatment or digital interventions to really be very efficient. But actually, rather than that bring the effectiveness down, we're actually getting more effectiveness as well.
Wow. OK. So, I mean, both of those are so exciting, aren't they? Because the potential to be able to reach more than the 2% of the population. And in your case, Kathy, can be reached by anybody at any time in a sort of widely available format, you know, is certainly, it's got to be the way of the future. Do you get any pushback, any challenge? I'm just thinking it might be quite a challenge to some psychologists. I don't know, is it? You know, the fact that you can reduce down a very lengthy treatment that requires a highly trained professional meeting one-on-one with somebody over many weeks into something that actually parents, for instance, can deliver themselves after a couple of hours of training. Is that challenging to the profession?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we haven't faced very much pushback. I mean, partly because I think that our digital intervention has very much coincided with the development of a new workforce in child mental health services. So we do now have a new workforce of psychological therapists who are trained specifically to deliver fairly brief treatments. So essentially they're there waiting for the treatments to come along for them to deliver. And they've been really fantastic in many cases at picking it up and running with it. And I think the reality is that services, you know, are so stretched. And so there is such a need to be able to really make the most of the resources that are there, that people have been just really pleased to have potentially efficient options. And certainly we just finished a trial called COCAT, where we were evaluating our online intervention in routine services all around England and Northern Ireland. And actually, that can be a really tricky setting to recruit in because services are so busy and everyone in working there is so busy. Yet, you know, we had 70 different clinical teams from around the country on board. And I think it was that potential to be able to do more with the available resources that was very appealing. So occasionally we have comments like that about, you know, about, are people going to be replaced? But I think as soon as people have experience of it, they realise, no, that's not the case. And it's interesting because people in our team who deliver, you know, who are really expert in delivering this treatment, say actually they really enjoy delivering it because they feel they really get to use their clinical skills because parents can access so much of the information online. And so their job is very much about personalising it and understanding what this family need. So that brings out all their clinical skills rather than having to, you know, repeat the same information that they might share with everybody. They can be very much focused on the individual family and listening to their needs and thinking about, you know, the particular challenges they might face. So hopefully people will find once they, you know, have a go at these sorts of interventions that they, it doesn't, you know, hopefully it can add and not take away from their experience as a clinician.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I would add is that one of the things that's really very much at the heart of what we do is working with young people with lived experience, with their parents, with their carers, with clinicians, with all the key people that are involved right from the get-go in our research. So actually, like, for example, Kathy's Aussie programme was co-designed, you know, involving all these people. So actually what we really try and ensure is we've got a highly acceptable treatment before we're even getting it out there that's going to work for clinicians, because they've been part of that group who's thought about what are all the, you know, challenges. And I think going forward, one of the things that's really important for us to think about all of these implementation issues, because it's all very well designing a nice treatment and then getting these outcomes, but actually it's another thing getting them into services. So we're really keen to sort of think about what we know about implementation science and different sort of ways of how do we maximise this research and these new treatments to make sure that actually we can address all the particular barriers that there might be to make sure we can actually get them into services.
Completely. But I suppose what you're talking about really is sort of developing like precision psychological therapies, aren't they? Because although they may be brief and although they may be able to be delivered with somebody without a PhD, that doesn't mean that they're not absolutely scientifically rigorously tested and better than, you know, the standard of care that was being provided before. I mean, that's what's so stunning, I guess. You can deliver a treatment that improves 100% of people with panic, adolescents with panic disorder, as opposed to something that took hours and hours of somebody's time before. I mean, that's just amazing.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And I think there's, you know, there's so much more, again, for us to learn, because, you know, there are particular treatment components and we have a really good understanding now of which are the really important bits that we need to maximise within treatment. But there's still lots of opportunity to think about and how should we do that? So, for example, in anxiety treatments, a lot of the focus for us is about doing actually the behavioural work. So we talked about it being cognitive therapy, but essentially it's about people doing different things in order to challenge their beliefs and learn new ways of making sense of the problem. Often we'll call it exposure. So essentially people do behavioural experiments. They'll go and do something perhaps that they might have ordinarily avoided and in order to kind of learn that actually some of the things that they're worried about might not happen. So we do lots of work around that. But we you know, there's a lot to be learned about how can we optimise that, how we can do it in the very best way. So I think what's exciting going forward is we can still continue to improve how do we deliver these treatments and look at some of these particular factors.
Yeah. So do you want to do a bit of a sort of a future look? What's really exciting, you know, coming down the track?
Yeah. Well, I think as much as we can get things onto these digital platforms, we're really keen to do that. I think one, obviously, for the access reason, but two, because also it does mean that we then can learn so much more quickly. So in the past, we would do, you know, trials and you'd be limited to a certain number of people in terms of just the feasibility of delivering face-to-face psychological therapies. But now we can, with these digital interventions, lots of the outcome measures we're collecting are built into the program. So every time people go on, you know, to a new module, they can complete measures. So we can see very clearly who's improving, who's not improving, when they're improving, you know, when things might stagnate. And because of the reach that you can get from digital interventions, you can learn so much from that. So we're already able to see, right, what are the outcomes looking like when we just let services use this outside of a trial? Reassuringly, they're looking really good. So that's really fantastic. As the numbers build up, we'll be able to say, okay, and who are the people that are not getting better? Can we identify them early on? Can we identify them from the early trajectory of their symptoms or how much they log in? By characteristics of those people. And then we can think, right, so what do those people need? How can we make the treatment work better for them in terms of making it more engaging or addressing key processes that might be getting in the way for them? So I think just the scale at which we'll be able to work with, because of having those digital routes and having the data caught within them, means that we should be able to really advance things in terms of improving outcomes much, much more rapidly than we ever have before. So I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that we're really keen to do is kind of expand the reach, because a lot of the treatments that we've developed have been focused on neurotypical children and young people. We know that rates of anxiety in particular are really high in autistic young people. So we're really keen to now extend what we know in order to ensure that treatments are available for everyone. And obviously, you know, some of that is about getting treatments out there, but it's also about tailoring to particular populations. So that's a particular area of focus for us going forward, is how do we adapt treatments to make them highly acceptable for people who really, really need that help.
I was going to ask exactly that, because, you know, anxiety often doesn't occur in isolation. So do these treatments work just as well if somebody has another mental illness or indeed a physical illness comorbid with their anxiety disorder?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And actually, Kathy's point about bigger data sets is going to be so helpful, because part of the challenge we have is often that our trials are relatively small, and therefore you might have a little bit of an indication of that, but you don't have enough data. So, you know, we know that in adolescent anxiety, often you do get some comorbidity with mood disorders, but often in our trials, you know, it might just be a handful of young people. So actually much bigger data sets will give us much more information about some of those factors, so we can really explore them, you know, in a better way.
Yeah, and we're collecting data currently in our routine use of Aussie, our online programme, about neurodiversity, because that's one of the main questions we want to look at there. But what we anticipate is that we are going to need to make adaptations. And so we've been doing some really fantastic work with colleagues at the University of Manchester who bring that expertise, where we've been working very closely with autistic young people, parents of autistic young people, autistic parents, about their experiences and their experiences of sort of standard CBT treatments. And it's been an absolutely fascinating journey. I've learned a huge amount from it. And really, you know, it's really made us realise how, you know, these treatments have been developed and delivered very much from a particular lens. And that maybe, you know, just not in a way that's going to work for everybody. And rather than us trying to sort of fit everybody into our single mold for how we deliver treatments, we actually need to be much more sort of flexible and have a much better understanding of people's individual needs. And I think that, you know, you hope that a good clinician does that. But I think, again, with the sorts of treatments we're trying to that we're developing, we want to make sure that's really built in from the start, so that people don't feel like they're being sort of, you know, squished into a square peg when it doesn't quite fit for them. So that's been such a fascinating project, and we're really hoping now that we'll get the funding to go forwards to fully adapt our Aussie programme, so that we have a Aussie for autism version that we're going to be then delivering with, you know, a lot of input from families and clinicians as well.
Wonderful. I love your acronyms as well. You have great set of acronyms in all of your studies. Lots of cats going
yes.
on. So if anyone's listening, they may be a young person who might be currently experiencing anxiety, or perhaps a parent of a child with an anxiety problem. What would you advise them to do?
So I think for parents, a place I would go to look to start with is actually a series that's edited by Polly and another one of our colleagues, Peter Cooper, which is in the Little Brown, from Little Brown Publishers. And all the books are called Helping Your Child With. So the first book from that series was one that I wrote with another colleague, Lucy Willits, called Helping Your Child With Fears and Worries. And that's the book that we have used as the basis for our original parent-led treatment, so that we've got good evidence that that's, you know, helpful for a good number of people. And there's now a really lovely set of other books there for parents. And I think, am I right in thinking there's going to be some books for young people coming soon too?
Yes, there are. So in fact, I mentioned Eleanor Lee and David Clark earlier, and they with colleagues have been writing a book focused on sort of social anxiety and confidence. So that book hopefully will be out in sort of 6 months or so. And there's another one focused on eating problems. So we're really trying to build up sort of resources that young people can make use of.
And one other place that is worth a look is that over recent years, I've led a UK research network focused on youth mental health called Emerging Minds. And as part of that, we led a project which actually started during the pandemic. And it was very much about working with young people to identify their mental health priorities, and then working with young people to create evidence-based resources. And so through that, we made a number of resources available in a number of different formats. So there's infographics, there's films, there's all sorts about a range of topics. But one of those topics is dealing with fears and worries about social situations, which is written in a very sort of young person friendly way. So if people have a look at the Emerging Minds website, if they just Google Emerging Minds UK, they'll be able to find that and find those resources for young people there. And actually, during the pandemic, we made a lot of webinars for families about just all the different challenges that families were facing, and people seem to be still using those now. So I think many of those things are still very live and haven't gone away whilst things have moved on somewhat with the pandemic. So that's another place to go to have a look for resources.
Polly, Kathy, thank you very much.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. You can find more episodes of Future Makers wherever you get your podcasts, and more on Oxford's research at ox.ac.uk/brain. Thanks for listening.